This autumn, the government's Levelling Up and Regeneration Bill became law, promising opportunities to be spread out across the country and not just concentrated in major cities down south. One of the architects of this vision is Andy Haldane, chair of the government's Levelling Up Advisory Council, former chief economist at the Bank of England for 8 years, part of a 30-year career at the bank, and now chief executive of the Royal Society of Arts. With 12 missions, from devolution deals for every part of England which wants one, to the reduction of the most serious crimes, Levelling Up seems to offer something for everyone. But could this also be its major flaw? We're very lucky to have Andy here for the final episode of Season 4 of the We Society podcast. He's the definition of someone putting the social sciences in motion. I'm Will Hutton, a journalist, author, economist, and president of the Academy of Social Sciences, who bring you this podcast series. Thanks so much, Andy, for joining us.
Will, wonderful to be here, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
Well, let's kick off with Levelling Up. Now, I'm on record as saying that the first two chapters of this white paper, which the analysis of regional inequality, spatial inequality in Britain, the various categories in which it's organised, the kind of innovative capital, financial capital, social capital, a really kind of way of structuring the way we think about spatial inequality is one of the kind of best things. And all the data that was gathered, kind of really remarkable. And then we get to the third chapter, which I thought was something of a fiasco, in which all the things that you call for aren't actually implemented. Now, you worked on this for 6 months of your life, and you're now chair of the Advisory Council. What's your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think at the time, that's a not unfair summary of the white paper, Will. I mean, truth is, the first two chapters were about setting out the framework, the diagnosis and the framework for tackling this, which was always going to be a long-term pursuit, will be a long-term pursuit. And the third chapter was about, you know, what you're doing today. And truth be told, not enough was being done at the time for that to look really credible, given the plan.
But you're also calling for stuff to be integrated, actions to be integrated. You didn't like the idea of there being lots of multiple pots and local government and various actors and local economies having to kind of compete all over again for different pots of money. I mean, you wanted it all put together and you didn't. I mean, and then you read all that's going to stand despite the framework.
Well, actually, on that front, that particular front, there has been some progress.
Oh, good.
So if you look at the two trailblazer deals done for Greater Manchester and the West Midlands and signed over the summer, they commit in both of those cases to a single settlement agreement in future, which would be a pulling together of the various disparate pots you mentioned and the provision of money to those two mayoral combined authorities on a long-term basis in a way that they themselves can choose how to spend it. So actually, that is now being put into practice in those two places. And indeed, the Secretary of State, Michael Gove, has committed that any other mayoral combined authority can come forward and ask for the same deal. So that's actually an example where there has been progress over the period since. Quite a lot of this has been drowned out by the noise of other stuff. But when it comes to matters devolution, and indeed the funding pots to support devolution, there's actually been quite a lot of progress over the period since the white paper had been published.
Let's go just spool back, actually, and get you to spell out, you know, the analysis. I mean, I think it was let's hear your voice describing the kind of drivers of regional spatial inequality in Britain.
Well, I think that one of the key points that has been missed historically, I think, Will, is that there isn't a single missing ingredient. You know, if you are to succeed in levelling up places, often what's missing is multiple ingredients. You know, I often get asked the question, you know, what's the biggest thing you do, Andy, to level up X, Y, or Z? And what's the missing ingredient in that place? And the truth is, making a place is a bit like baking a cake. And the most important ingredient when baking a cake is the ingredient that's missing. And the ingredient that's missing is different in different places. And of course, in places doing least well, it's multiple ingredients that are missing. Sometimes it's the lack of business. Sometimes it's the poor infrastructure. Sometimes it's the poor education. Sometimes it's the absence of social infrastructure in its many and various forms. In many of the worst hit places, it's all of the above. So the key point was, it's not just all about one thing, skills. It can be a whole range of things. And therefore, that's why you need 12 missions, not a singular mission. I'd have liked nothing better, Will, than to have had a singular mission, because singular is simple. But singular is also a misdiagnosis of what UK PLC and its many and various component parts needs right now. And that's why it has to be a cross-governmental endeavour, because it isn't just one thing. It's all of the moving parts of Whitehall. And indeed, even more importantly, it's having those moving parts exercised locally rather than from Whitehall.
And so your pushback from my introduction would be, it's not something for everyone, and that's the weakness. You're saying the 12 missions are a suite of options which need to be customised for particular places.
Well, not even a suite of options. They are necessary conditions for success. It isn't a pick and mix counter. You need each and every one of them to be in place to lift the fortunes of a place on a durable and sustainable basis. Let me give you an example, right? You could smash out the park when it came to businesses in a place, to infrastructure, whether physical or digital, in a place. But if that place still has nowhere to go after 6 p.m. in an evening, it lacks the theatres, the high streets, the youth clubs, the football clubs, no one will want to live there and it will not succeed. So it's always a question of a broad range of fronts on which you must make progress as part of a coordinated local plan. And that's why it requires coordination. And it's also why that plan cannot be executed from the centre. It must be executed locally, which is why Devo is so important.
Now, it's strong on devolution. It's strong on human capital. It's strong on physical infrastructure. But one of the areas when I found it was persuasive, but I thought I wasn't sure you'd actually got to the root of it, was the social capital part.
Yeah.
And I just thought, what can, even if you decentralise to a kind of well-devolved kind of urban administration, whatever character, what can it do to promote social capital? And we might like to define it for our listeners who kind of might say, what's Will talking about? What's Andy Haldane talking about?
Yeah, well, on social capital, I mean, first thing is I was absolutely clear going in that I wanted social capital as a key part of the raw ingredients, and it got in there. And that's despite the best efforts of a number of, Whitehall departments who've chose to turn a blind eye over many years. What is it? Well, in some ways, it's that set of relationships, the trust that exists within communities, the social glue that we know is crucial to getting things done. It's about sometimes broken down social capital into bonding capital. That is to say, the common causes or objectives or aims that glue us together as a society. And bridging capital. That is to say, the connections that exist within a community or within a place. And how is it nurtured? It's nurtured by investing consistently and comprehensively in social infrastructure, which is that nexus of things we mentioned earlier on. It includes decent high streets and the museum, the library, the youth club, the football club, the green spaces that we want to occupy. And the truth is, as a nation, we have structurally underinvested in that social infrastructure relative to the more common infrastructures, the physical and the digital, that dominate debate. If you break down the investment in places across different parts of the UK, one, you see absolutely astronomical differences in the scale of that investment. And two, if you dig down into how that money has been spent, the tiniest of sliver goes towards the social infrastructure compared with the other two. And that's a big miss. We give it some welly in the white paper. Does it need even greater welly? I would say absolutely yes. I mean, it's striking if you look at the evidence either within countries or between countries that those countries or communities that have the highest social capital also do best when it comes to more objective measures of income or well-being. That, for me, is not an accidental fact. You know, without relationships, without bonds of trust, places will not work and will not survive. And the evidence suggests that very, very clearly. Is it yet in our policy bloodstream? No, not sufficiently.
It's amazing, actually, the extent to which social capital lives on. I mean, I was doing some background reading before interviewing you, talking to you, and I was struck, for example, in Italy, the city-states, you know, Bologna or Vicenza or Modena, whatever, Ferrara, that were kind of city-states in the Middle Ages and had were self-governing communities, still have, close to 500 years later, higher levels of social capital than other parts of Italy.
Yes.
You know, and it just kind of, it's generative. It goes on and on and on. And actually, you know, desperately, large parts of the Midlands and the north of England have not had that.
Not had that. It applies at every geographic scale. So, you know, I've been very struck, reinforcing your point, Will, by the recent, I think, amazing research that Raj Shetty's been doing in the US. This is a superstar Harvard social scientist. Now, Raj did this earlier work, very influential, which was constructing an opportunity atlas circle for the US, which was a very granular breakdown of which parts of the US were good in nurturing social mobility, generational progress, and which were very poor in doing that. That was a fascinating piece of work because it was a very patchwork quilt map, opportunity atlas in terms of which areas enabled generational progression and which ones did not. But even more interesting for me is this recent research that builds on that. Well, what it does is take this amazing database from Facebook, actually, from Meta, and construct a social network from it. Who knows who and how well do they know them? What is your social network? Who's in it and how big is it? And then he poses the question, a very interesting hypothesis, can that social network help explain patterns, spatial patterns, of social mobility in the US? You can probably guess the punchline that emerged from this, which is not just can the social network help explain patterns of social mobility. It does a better job than any other indicator that you could look at. And by some margin, Will. So this is really is, I mean, it's a point we all know in our heart of hearts.
I know that research a little bit, and it goes on to argue that actually the more that you bridge kind of social and ethnic divides, then the more rich the results are.
Absolutely. So you know, whether it's ethnic divides or socioeconomic divides, you know, you put rich and poor kids together in the same classroom, that is a huge leg up in progress terms to the poor kid and comes at worst no harm to the rich kid.
So people should send their kids to state schools, not to private schools.
We are doing now the same thing for the UK. Working with Meta to see
The Royal Society of Arts,
the RSO, yeah. We're doing the UK leg of this now. And I'm excited about it. One, because, you know, I'm a nerd, as you know, and therefore working with billions of data observations to figure out, you know, the patterns.
This is social science at work, Andy. It's not nerdish.
It's very important. It's geek chic, Will. You know, I'm all for it. But the important part, you know, that I'm actually even more excited about than the data bit, the nerdy researchy bit, is what we do with it. Because I want to take this into the field, right? I want to say, look, we know what connections really count for promoting social mobility in a place like Sunderland, where I was born. And I want to reconfigure the institutions in that place, indeed in every place, to be actively nurturing of social mobility. So there's absolutely no reason why, if the key location for doing this is schools, why we can't actively intervene in schools to make this happen, or indeed in the workplace, or perhaps the best mixing environment is not educational work, but sports or social activities.
Yeah.
I mean, interesting, what Chetty finds in the US is, what do you think is the institution in the US that's gets the richest mix socioeconomically between rich and poor?
American football, I'd imagine.
Church is the answer.
Ah. Well, that's declining a little bit, isn't it? I mean, I think
in the US it is. And that pattern almost certainly will not be matched here in the UK. But nonetheless, whether it's social sphere or educational sphere or work sphere, could we think of interventions that the evidence, the nerdy evidence suggests could make a real difference to disadvantaged kids' life chances against a backdrop where patterns of social mobility in this country have not budged for at least 50 years and arguably for 200 years. If this could turn the key even a little bit and unlock that opportunity in people, hallelujah. That's as good as it gets when it comes to social science and social policy, is it not?
I just want to take a moment to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the We Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. As you were speaking, I mean, you probably weren't aware of it, it's really, you know, you're passionate. You know, your body language is really passionate. And I'm thinking to myself, is this the kid from the council estate in Sunderland wants to kind of, you know?
Of course it is. I mean, we all come from somewhere, right? And we can't not be shaped by our experience. And I'm like everyone else in that respect. And I lucked out, you know, doors opened conveniently at convenient moments. And that's why I'm lucky sitting here talking to someone like you. But lots of people equally or more talented than me didn't have that luck, didn't have that opportunity. And finding ways of nurturing. And in some ways, that is what the Levelling Up White Paper for me was all about. You know, it is about unlocking potential in people and in places, which we know will, from the evidence, because it's clear as the nose on your face, have not had that opportunity. That for many people, history is destiny. And that's what the absence of social mobility is about, that you're locked in by your background. For others, their geography is their destiny, because where they grow up determines where they end up. And for many, of course, that they are bound in both by their history and by their geography.
Yeah.
And that leaves them doubly constrained. We need to be able to unlock those chains from people with potential.
I completely agree. My invitation is, it's not only kind of some people's potential may take them to be chief economist of the Bank of England and do the things that you've done in your life, but some of them may, you know, maybe being a great boxer or starting a kind of being a great fisherman or whatever it might be.
Completely.
I mean, it's not.
Completely.
It's a kind of, you know, it's a.
We all have our different pathways, and it really isn't about size of job, much less income from job. It's about satisfaction in your job. And I mean, one of the topics I know you and I have discussed in the past is, and in some ways a manifestation of what we're describing, Will, has been how much less likely it is that you are to become an entrepreneur if you're from a poor background.
Yeah.
And
you picked up on this phrase, which I like a lot, of the lost Einsteins.
Or to make it more gender neutral, or the lost Marie Curies as well.
Okay, quite right.
You know, I think there's not, in terms of giving people agency over their life, being an entrepreneur, I think, is of tremendous value. But in terms of having your own business, something that is yours, that you own and take responsibility for, and nurture and grow and cultivate relationships, customers and clients, I think that's a tremendously virtuous thing. And that lots of people who could do it well are being constrained from putting their foot on the is really depressing. And what they lack, Will, when you look into it, you know, what are the lost Curies and Einsteins missing? Well, to a degree, it's cash. You need a bit of money, a bit of seed corn capital to get started if you're running a business. But actually, the larger thing they miss from the evidence is what we've just discussed, which is connections. These kids have never met anyone who would call themselves an entrepreneur. And they certainly haven't got a network, a social network, of ready-made entrepreneurs. And that is something that is eminently fixable. You don't need loads of money. Imagine about the Duchetti work, and about that is that it doesn't take buckets of cash. to connect people to other people. And if that's a springboard for discovering the lost Einsteins and Curies, for creating a new cohort of self-sanding, agency-providing entrepreneurs in the poorer parts of the country, I mean, that too would be a huge boon right now to our economy, which is, you know, stuck in the mud.
Now, our economy's stuck in the mud. I can't have the former chief economist of the Bank of England in the studio without discussing this for a bit. Stuck in the mud? Why do you say that? I mean, I have my own answer to that, but I want your answer.
Yeah, I mean, the data, God bless it, is, I mean, reasonably clear. We certainly haven't moved as an economy for the last 18 months. And if you believe the forecast my former shop put out just yesterday, Will, it will be moving for the next 18 months, much in growth terms.
Your former shop, the Bank of England.
The Bank of England, yeah. That is. The data makes clear the extent of the treading water that the economy has been undertaking, looking backwards and prospectively looking forwards. I think treading water might be optimistic over the next 18 months.
That's my view too, by the way, yeah.
I think we may well find ourselves sinking sedately below the waterline over the next 6 to 9 months. But let's see.
What's driving this? I mean, it's ghastly. I mean, the rate of growth of productivity has been negligible for, you know, more than 15 years now. Mm. Rates of investment, you know, sorely below long-run averages. There are bright spots, you know, the startups, the unicorns, you know, the companies that are growing from nothing to kind of $1 billion. But, I mean, it's a very, very sad landscape. I mean, if you had to put your finger on the drivers and how you'd get yourself onto a virtuous circle where these things aren't happening, what would you be doing?
Well, in some ways, the diagnosis is really easy. There's a very simple explanation for why we haven't really grown at anything like the pace we could and should have been doing, not just relative to our past, but relative to other countries. And that is a failure to invest. It really is that simple. We know that that's the wellspring of boosts to productivity and therefore to income or GDP or pay over the long term. And the truth is we've been through a 15 years and counting drought when it comes to private sector business investment. We've gone through a 15 years and counting drought when it comes to public investment, and that's in physical stuff. And it's been accompanied by a drought of at least that duration when it comes to investment in what's sometimes called human capital, as distinct from physical capital, that is the education and skills and experience of our workforce. On all three fronts, we fare poorly, not just by historical comparison, but by international comparison as well. If you don't invest in those things, Will, your productivity will not grow and neither will your economy or pay packets. And that has been the story of the last 15 years.
Now, there's various dimensions of this. I mean, some of that manifests itself in the inequality that we've been discussing, in the lack of levelling up. It's not for want of exhortation. I mean, talk to anybody, they say, we've got to raise investment. What's inhibiting it? Why, you know, if you had to put your finger on one or two kind of the most important causes of this, what would they be?
Let me take one each from public investment, private investment, and from human capital investment, just to make it nice and simple. And let me take public investment first. That is the smaller part of investment. But then again, the public sector is a smaller part of the economy, so that probably makes sense. Have we been leading by example when it comes to public investment? No, we have not. We've fared poorly on that front. And that's in part, I think, because we've boxed ourselves into what I think are frankly fairly silly fiscal rules that prioritise insufficiently investment on a sustained basis over the medium term.
Now, let's get this. I mean, there'll be people who get it immediately and people are kind of, fiscal rules, you know, suddenly kind of thinking this is above my head. I mean, brutally, what you're saying is that the economic establishment, the public economic establishment, the economic leadership of that in the form of Chancellor Exchequer and successive Treasury teams have prioritised lowering debt, lowering taxes over investment, and that actually that's reinforced by a kind of, and I saw a very important piece you wrote on this, we don't account for our public balance sheet properly. So you don't look at the schools, the hospitals, the R&D, the infrastructure that we've developed that.
Well, I mean, if you're a business making choices about how to spend your money, you think, what I want to do actually is make those spending choices in a way that boosts the net worth of my business over the medium term, right? You wouldn't fixate on a measure of debt or a measure of debt servicing to do that. You'd say, what are the choices I want to make, the investments I want to make to nurture the assets of tomorrow that boost the net worth of the organization? That will be balance sheet management 101 if you're a business, Will. And yet, when it comes to managing the national economy, we somehow don't do that. We do fixate on the debt part. I'm not saying it's unimportant, but if that's at the expense of investing in the assets and therefore the incomes of tomorrow, we are missing a huge trick. And we have a focus on debt over short horizons has led to a structurally underinvesting in assets, in the net worth of the country as a whole, in a way that have limited public investment and therefore productivity growth. So our fiscal rules have, you know, people say, you know, the debt ratio is too high. The ratio of debt to GDP is too high. That might well be. But the next obvious question is, how then do you want to lower it? And if you look at the
either raise GDP or...
Do you shrink the numerator through austerity or grow the denominator through growth? Let me tell you, the first is self-defeating. The only route out is to grow out of a debt hole, not to dig yourself deeper into one. And that's why investment in the roads, in the schools, in education, in schools, the wellspring of growth, is the right route to getting debt, even in those terms, down. By boosting the denominator, the growth, you know, the investment pays for itself. So I think that has been an element of what's gone wrong. I really get the impression from what I just said that the route to redemption is all through just spend. I do not think that at all. I think the mobilization of private finance through business investment is absolutely the key to elevating places and to elevating the national economy. The truth is, Will, as you know, the world is absolutely awash with cash. Right. This is a conversation you and I have been having for at least a decade, if not longer.
Yes.
It's just that too little of that cash currently is finding its way into the right businesses and the right places of the country to yield the biggest return. We have, as you know, £3 trillion pot of pension money, but only the tiniest slither of which goes into UK businesses. Of course we can change that. That's before we even get to the massive pot of foreign money that prospectively could find a home here, if we could find a way of putting in place a serviceable pipeline of projects right around the country, businesses right around the country, which we absolutely can, and match up that chronic demand for investment in poorer places with the plentiful supply of patient capital that is out there. And some of the work at the RSA has been about how do we connect demand with supply locally to nurture that investment and to nurture that growth.
And we're getting near the end now. And I've kind of, there's two kind of things in my mind. I'm thinking, you know, listeners would like to hear maybe just a little bit about, you know, you the man. I mean, you know, here you are, amazing kind of, I mean, back streets of Sunderland to, you know, the pinnacles of the Bank of England. And actually, you know, you're one of the driving forces besides some of the public policy innovations of our time. I'm interested in what are the private conversations you have with yourself in the bath or in the shower? You know, who is Andy Haldane? I want to know.
Yeah, less interesting than you think, Will. But I've been driven from an early age, I suppose, by public service. I think I always wanted to be a public servant. Thus far, I always have been a public servant. I hope I always remain a public servant. That gives me huge amounts of psychic rent. It's not always great for actual rent, but it's great for psychic rent, you know.
Psychic rent.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I've ever heard anyone talk about psychic rent. Only you could talk about psychic rent.
Well,
actually,
that's
one of the
things
about you, actually. I mean, I was thinking of the dog and the frisbee, one of your... you come up with these titles for things, you know. When you look at the Bank of England website, look at the speeches, the Haldane speeches always got these extraordinary titles. I mean, where does that come from?
Well, some of that is...
Where does psychic rent come from?
It's certainly not my... Almost certainly those expressions be you know, begged, borrowed and stolen from someone, somewhere. I've made a point and very much have enjoyed being able to work in a cross-disciplinary fashion, you know, very much true to the academy and social sciences, but I'd like to bridge from social sciences into natural sciences and indeed to the arts and humanities, actually, because the fusion of those that was the wellspring of the Enlightenment movement and will be the wellspring of the new Enlightenment, which I hope we can usher in economically and societally.
Wouldn't that be great?
I love the crucible of creativity that comes from reading and learning from and hopefully applying in the field lessons from different disciplines to common problems that we face. And sometimes when you do that, it throws up characters or throws up metaphors or throws up stories that are useful in cutting through to a wider audience. You mentioned Dog and Frisbee. I mean, that was drawn from a study that I read about how it is that dogs catch Frisbees and the psychological heuristics that they use in Frisbee catching are the same ones that we use as humans. You know, they make a complex problem very, very simple. So I do think it helps having that wide-angle lens on your discipline, which means looking beyond your discipline to other disciplines, something that economists haven't always been as they might have been. And combining that, I suppose, maybe a little bit with an eye to what might work. That's why, you know, I've made a point of wanting to be able to go along to the most academic audience imaginable and to hold my own and present an academic paper, be the uber nerd, if you like. But equally, I've spent as much time with communities or charities on the ground, listening to them and trying to explain my story of the economy to them. I need to be able to work off either foot equally well. One of the reasons I spend so much time speaking in schools is because it's without question the best media training known to human beings, right? Because they are the most unforgiving audience.
Yeah. Trying to hold an audience.
Hold an audience with them. And if you can do that, you can do anywhere, right? So speaking to every cohort of society in a language that is theirs, not mine, and being able to straddle across disciplines, natural and social sciences, arts and humanities. And also straddling, I think, Will, the third dimension I'd mention, is straddling across sectors. Because on the face of it, my career looks like it's been lodged pretty firmly in the public sector. But actually, I think in terms of where I've spent my time, I've spent about a third of my time facing off to business in the private sector, a third of my time facing off to government and working with government, a third of my time facing off to civil society in the charitable sector. And for me, and this is born of history and quite a lot of theory, the absolute bliss point is the partnership, if you can create it, between public, private, and civil society. That was the essence of the Enlightenment, going back to that. Many of the greatest leaps forward societally have come from that fusion of sectors and the fusion of disciplines and the fusion of stakeholders societally. And I think that's where I've pitched my tent.
The Enlightenment. You've mentioned that a few times now. How hopeful are you? I mean, here we are. I mean, just to round this off, if you talk about devolution, I mean, Birmingham City Council's gone bust, you know. So there's that, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we talk about education and, you know, spending on education is at dismal levels. You know, the economy is in a sad state, as you described. We've seen quite a long way away from any kind of enlightenment with, you know, people kind of anxious to kind of close down kind of discourse with safe spaces and all the rest. I mean, just give us a sense of, you know, there's all those downsides. I mean, you're quite a Tiggerish kind of guy. Can you find optimism for us? I mean, how would you, you know, just round this off. Just what, you know, what's the Haldane view?
I'm hugely optimistic right now, Will. And you have to be. Because it's contagious. We need to be contagious right now. When I travel around the country, I can spot a mile off places on the up and places stuck in the mud. And it's about the story they tell about themselves, Will. So if the story that people tell about their places or about their lives is one that looks backwards and down, I know they're stuck. And in a way, the story we're telling ourselves nationally right now is looking backwards and down, quite fatalistic, quite defeatist, because our recent history has not been the history any of us would wish. But by contrast, when I go to places that are on the up, the story they tell themselves is not backward looking and down, but forward-looking and up. And seizing on those things, maybe just a glimmer of success, and seizing it and leaning into it and investing in it. There are loads of aspects of UK PLC where there are those glimmers. It could be our brilliant businesses, of which there are many. It could be our brilliant people, of which there are many. It could be our brilliant universities or research institutes, of which there are many. It could be our creative industries, our capacity for creativity. All of those are huge assets and give me grounds for us needing to be optimistic about our future, sufficient, provided we invest in it. So funnily enough, the flip side of us having got so many things wrong, of not having unlocked the potential in so many people and in so many places, is that there is a huge amount now of latent energy in the UK economy and in UK society. And it's our job, Will, you in your role, all of your listeners, and certainly me in mine, to seek ways to unlock that potential, to carry that spirit and story of optimism. Because without it, we will remain stuck. With it, we have a chance of changing the narrative.
Well, Andy, you've that's an inspiring way to end. Look, you've been a... And we've known each other for a while, but I feel I've got essence of Haldane this afternoon. Your commitment to levelling up, unlocking potential, that was well done. Your role of how you spoke about social capital and the role of networks, your view of the kind of lack of investment in the UK and public and private and so on, and you're giving us kind of window into you. It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much. And that's it from the We Society podcast, the last in our series. And thank you so much, Andy Haldane.
Thank you so much, Will. It's been fantastic, as ever, speaking to you.
The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Find out more about the Society by going to www.acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast so you're the first to know when a new episode comes out.